60. Learn from a model. When young people get their real jobs, they may face a lot of new confusing situations. They may find that everything is different from the way things were at school. It is also possible that they will feel uncomfortable in both professional and social situations. Eventually, they realize that university classes can't be the only preparation for all of the different situations that appear in the working world. Perhaps the best way to learn how to behave in the working world is to identify a worker you admire and observe his behavior. In doing so, you'll be able to see what it is that you admire in this person. For example, you will observe how he acts in a trouble. Perhaps even more important, you'll be able to see what is his approach to everyday situations. While you are observing your colleague, you should be asking yourself whether his behavior is like yours, and now how you can learn from his response to a different situation. By watching and learning from a model, you will probably begin to identify and get good working habits.
61. Flexible time. Both late sleepers and early risers find the fixed hours of a 9-to-5 workday a problem. Now, there is an answer that seems to please them both. Employees of some businesses, organizations, and government agencies in the U.S. are adapting their work hours to suit their individual needs. It's called flexible time, and it means, for example, that employees can start working at any time during the first 3 hours their office is open and leave after completing their required daily working time. Early risers can begin work at 7 a.m., finish at 3, and still have daylight time for shopping, picking up children at school, or recreation. Late sleepers need not report for work until 10 a.m., but they must stay on their job until 6 in the evening. Says a bank official in Boston, Massachusetts, "All employees like the system, and slow movement has been actually disappeared. Few people are absent, turnover has dropped markedly, and productivity and morale have risen."
62. Different purposes of working. Careerists are people whose self-image is determined almost exclusively by their jobs. Virtually everything they do is designed to advance their careers. They are defined by their jobs. When you meet a careerist at a party, he immediately tells you his occupation. Take away a careerist's job, and he doesn't know who he is. He loses his identity. His life is seriously out of balance. This particular disease is called careerism. Workaholics may or may not be careerists. Workaholics also spend most of their time and energy on their jobs, but there may be different reasons for their work pattern. They may not even identify with their jobs. Work may simply be an escape, an effort to avoid dealing with life. On the other hand, a workaholic may love his job and simply become addicted to the pleasure of doing it, and doing it well. Careerists may not even like their jobs. In fact, they may not even work that hard. They may spend most of their time on organizational politics for advancement. Careerists are not so much into work as into seeking identity through their jobs, their career advancement, and the symbols of success. A workaholic may be working to help others or to support a noble cause. If we are working on projects we see as important to social transformation, it is easy to become obsessed with the project and let other areas of our lives slide. We must all strive to avoid this pitfall. Managers must be alert to both careerists and workaholics, recognize the differences, and seek to help both move in the direction of wholeness.
63. An engineer's necessities. All engineers need a knowledge of mathematics and physics, no matter what their special field of work is. Most young people who wish to be engineers begin studying these subjects early in high school. An interest in mathematics and physics is essential because every engineer must work with these sciences. Students preparing for engineering college should also study chemistry, mechanical drawing, and other science subjects that are offered. A good command of language is important because engineers must be able to talk and write clearly. A knowledge of economics, history, and other social science subjects is also helpful. To best fulfill their duties in society, engineers need to know not only how to do their work, but also how their work will influence other people. They need to be able to help make decisions on many problems. Engineering college usually takes a few years to complete, although some schools give 5-year courses. After finishing a year or two of college, an engineering student begins to concentrate on a special field. Part of the student's time is spent in the classroom, and part is spent in the laboratory doing experiments. In some schools, students spend part of the year studying and part of the year working in their chosen field.
64. Advantages of a job interview. Nowadays, when a person is hunting for a job, there will always be a job interview, through which the interviewee and the interviewer can know about each other. Therefore, I think that the job interview has many advantages. During the interview, the interviewer lets the interviewee know something about the job, such as the wage, the working conditions, and chances to get promotion. Then, the interviewee can decide whether the job is really suitable for him. Besides, the job interview is also a good chance for the interviewee because he can impress the interviewer by showing both his ability and his confidence. He can tell the interviewer in person about his educational background or his working experience. Thus, the interviewer can figure out whether he is the right person for the job. In addition, the job interview will do good to both the interviewer and the interviewee. By means of interview, the interviewee can find a good job and the interviewer can find a suitable person if both of them make the best of the job interview.
65. Mid-career program. Life begins at 40 is more often an expression of hope than a statement of fact. But it has the ring of truth for a group of mature women at the University of Pittsburgh whose professional lives are really just beginning. A former housewife who is seeking a PhD and teaching at the university had received the highest student evaluation in the university's history. A mother of four, who never had a policy-making position in previous part-time work, is now deputy director in the Department of Planning for the city of Pittsburgh. And another woman, who without a college degree has trouble finding a good job, had been accepted as the first woman professor at UCLA's Graduate School of Management. These successful professionals are all graduates of a unique program designed to help mature women prepare for positions in public administration and planning. The mid-career scholars fit no mold. Many saw their child-rearing years growing to a close and wanted to find a productive, useful career. Some, unexpectedly forced into the role of family provider by a divorce, needed training that they had not thought necessary when they were younger. Other women in the program were eager to join because they had had no chance to go to college in their youth. One, for instance, who had hoped to go on to graduate school, put her efforts and money into helping her younger sister get an education instead.
66. Is failure a bad thing? Failure is a common thing in our daily life, or rather, it is part of life. Even Edison, for example, the inventor of the light bulb, made hundreds of models that had failed before he found the right way to make one. When we play games, we cannot avoid being beaten by others. And there are times when we fail to do more satisfactory work. So failure happens naturally, and almost every one of us has experienced it. However, there are different attitudes towards failure. Some people lose heart, and some even collapse in failure. They think the world is at its end. Some people don't take failure seriously, and they just let it be. Some others believe that failure may be a way toward success, and so they can learn much from failure, and therefore see the light of hope through failure. In my opinion, what really counts is not failure itself, but what we think of failure and do after failure. As long as we don't give up and, in the meantime, learn something from failure, we'll certainly turn failure into success. Always keep it in mind that failure is the mother of success.
67. Sense of responsibility. I grew up in a small town. My father raised chickens, and ran a construction company. I was barely 10 years old when my dad gave me the responsibility of feeding the chickens and cleaning up the stable. He believed it was important for me to have those jobs to learn responsibility. Then, when I was 22, I found a job in Natchville at a country music subclub called the Natchville Palace. I washed dishes and cooked from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. and then went on stage and sang until 2 in the morning. It wasn't long before I became known as a singer-cook. I had been rejected so many times by record companies that it was hard not to be discouraged. One night, a woman executive from a company named Warner Brothers Records came to hear me sing. When the show was over, we sat down and talked, and then she left. I said to myself, it was one more rejection. A few weeks later, my manager received a phone call. Warner Brothers wanted to sign me to a record deal. Soon after, I released my first record in June 1986. It sold over 1 million copies. My best efforts had gone into every job I ever held. It was the sense of responsibility that made me feel like a man. Knowing that I had done my best filled me with pride. I still feel that way today, even though I have become a well-known singer.
68. Competition and cooperation. Competition is common in every field of life. For example, the Olympic Games are the most famous competition in the world. In the 400-meter swimming race, the swimmers plunge into the water at the signal. Each swings his arms and legs and tries his best to be the first. Also, there is the competition for jobs, for promotion, for customers, and so on. We can say, in a certain sense, competition stimulates people's interest in work and helps society to go forward. We often find that competition goes hand in hand with cooperation. Take, for example, a volleyball match. The members of the team cooperate with each other. One serves the ball. Then another passes the ball to a certain height for a still other to hit it over the net while the other members try to block it on its return. It requires good teamwork to win the game. While we advocate competition, we cannot forget cooperation. Human beings are social beings. No one exists alone in the society. If you want to play the game well, you have to play with others. You have to cooperate with your playmates. From cooperation, we get mutual help and understanding. With cooperation, the world is progressing at peace and harmony.
69. The successful interview. To be successful in a job interview, the applicant should show certain personal and professional qualities. Inasmuch as the first and often lasting impression of a person is decided by the clothes he wears, the job applicant should take care to appear well-groomed and modestly dressed, avoiding the extremes of too elaborate or too casual. Besides care for personal appearance, he should pay attention to his manner of speaking, which should be neither ostentatious nor familiar, but rather straightforward, accurate, and friendly. In addition, he should be prepared to talk knowledgeably about the requirements of the position for which he is applying in relation to his own professional experience and interests. And finally, the really impressive applicant must convey a sense of self-confidence and enthusiasm for work, factors which all interviewers value highly. The job seeker who displays these characteristics, with just a little luck, will certainly succeed in the typical personnel interview.
70. How to survive in a fire. Many people now live or work in very high buildings. It is often not so easy to get away from these buildings in an emergency. So, how to survive in case of a fire is a question concerning all those involved. No one knows for sure when a fire will happen, so it is extremely necessary to make preparations before a fire starts. Check the fire escape in advance and make sure that you can find it in the dark after lights have failed. Find out where the nearest fire extinguisher is and read the instructions to learn how to use it. Don't lose your head if, unfortunately, a fire breaks out. First, telephone the fire department immediately when the fire just gets started. Take care not to be overcome by smoke, which, containing carbon monoxide gas, can kill you quickly. Cover your face with a wet towel and avoid getting in the smoke. Don't get in an elevator, as you may get trapped if the electricity fails. Lastly, it is of great importance to try to hang something out of the window to attract attention as a sign asking for help. In short, if you make preparations beforehand and take precautions in the fire, you will have more chances to survive in case a fire really breaks out someday.
71. If you are shy, you are not alone. Are you afraid to raise your hand in class, even when you know the answer? If you are, most people would say that you are shy. If you feel shy, you are not alone. 9 out of 10 people are at least a little shy, but however shy you are, scientific evidence seems to show that it isn't your fault. You may have been born that way. How do psychologists measure shyness? One way is by observation. They keep detailed records of people's actions, like how often these people speak to others, or how long it takes someone to say hello to a stranger. Another way to measure shyness is to ask people questions. The test only takes about 10 minutes. It asks questions like, do you like going out a lot? And, do you have many friends? People must answer either yes or no. These questions can predict how people actually behave in social situations. Suppose the test tells you that someone is shy. Chances are good that person will act shy. When scientists measure shyness, they are really comparing degrees of shyness. In other words, when researchers say people are shy, they really mean they are more shy than others.
72. Color effects. At the University of Kansas Art Museum, investigators tested the effects of different colored walls on two groups of visitors to an exhibit of paintings. For the first group, the room was painted white. For the second, dark brown. Movement of each group was followed by an electrical system under the carpet. The experiment revealed that those who entered the dark brown room walked more quickly, covered more area, and spent less time in the room than the people in the white environment. Dark brown stimulated more activity, but the activity ended sooner. Not only the choice of colors, but also the general appearance of a room communicates and influences those inside. Another experiment presented subjects with photographs of faces that were to be rated in terms of energy and well-being. Three groups of subjects were used. Each was shown the same photos, but each group was in a different kind of room. One group was in an ugly room that resembled a messy storeroom. Another group was in an average room, a nice office. The third group was in a tastefully designed living room with carpeting and drapes. Results show that the subjects in the beautiful room tended to give higher ratings to the faces than did those in the ugly room. Other studies suggest that students do better on tests taken in comfortable, attractive rooms than in ordinary-looking or ugly rooms.